Live from New York, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. This is an in-depth, original, investigative report, a white paper. It is part two of an ongoing series challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Fully documented, vetted for accuracy, the information I'm presenting is posted on all of my websites, ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, GaryKnoll.com, and my Facebook. The article is entitled Voodoo Science, The Myth of Vaccine Efficacy. The two pillars upon which the entire edifice of vaccinology rests are that vaccines are safe and effective. We are told by our medical and federal authorities, physicians, pharmacists, and healthcare practitioners that vaccines work by stimulating the body's immune system to create specific antibodies. These antibodies, in turn, protect us from the infectious disease specific to a given vaccine, such as polio, smallpox, chickenpox, measles. The central premise is virtually never challenged. Hundreds of millions of Americans simply accept that all vaccines are scientifically proven to confer immunity against disease. In a previous broadcast entitled Uncovering the Cover-Up, Scientific Analysis of the Vaccine Autism Connection, Deeply Flawed U.S. Vaccine Policies, I examined the myths about vaccine safety and presented the actual science demonstrating vaccines' toxic ingredients and adverse neurological effects. This report investigates the medical industry's claims that vaccines are effective. Moreover, the independent quality research in peer-reviewed journals presented for each major vaccine raises serious questions that challenge the concept of antibody generation as a reliable factor to assure viral and bacterial immunity. Every flu season, millions of Americans visit their physician's office or local pharmacy to receive a flu shot. Recipients are given one of a handful of influenza vaccines on the market. The same vaccine will be injected into a 14-pound infant, teenage athletes weighing 200 pounds, and frail, immunocompromised elderly patients, regardless of age, weight, medical history, previously compromised immune system, and any other health factor, including genetics, they are all given the same exact chemical cocktail. Furthermore, we are told to accept that this one-size-fits-all approach is predictably positive resulted in the production of a number of protective antibodies that will ward off a flu infection. Once the flu season concludes, vaccine-induced immunity in persons who made it through the season without contracting a diagnosed flu infection are categorized by our health officials as having been successfully immunized. And these statistics then stand as living proof of the vaccine's efficacy. Meanwhile, very little, if any, attention is paid to the numerous other factors that have been shown to influence immunity, including the quality of our diet, additional specific nutrients such as vitamin D and A and C and B complex and zinc, all of which are shown to impact in a positive way our immunity. Herbs such as echinacea, astragalus, podiarco are also beneficial to the immune system based upon thousands of studies in peer-reviewed literature. So also, you could add other herbs such as curcumin, and ginkgo, and ginseng. Then you have to look at the quality and extent and type of exercise. That, too, is supported in the scientific literature. Stress management, whether or not you overreact to a stressful event, chronic or acute, or whether you're able to go to a more neutral place and not allow your hormones to run amok. Also, we work in different environments that are frequently toxic. We live in environments that have outgassing from particle boards in cabinets and desks and formaldehyde in carpets. And even our sleep patterns directly impact our immunity and hence susceptibility. Do we get a good quality night's sleep? Is it interrupted? Do we have electromagnetic pulses from cell phones and computers and overhead towers that impact our biochemistry and our genetic makeup? A person who chooses to be vaccinated and follows a healthy lifestyle by eating a balanced, wholesome, plant-based diet, minimizing environmental toxins, engaging in regular exercise, and practicing de-stress techniques is far less likely to fall sick. It is therefore impossible scientifically and completely unscientific to make any absolute claims that vaccines are the sole protective cause for not contracting an infectious illness. On the other hand, an unvaccinated individual who eats the standard American diet suffers from multiple nutritional deficiencies and leads a sedentary, high-stress lifestyle, has a higher risk of developing a significantly compromised immune system condition. If such a person comes down with an illness, how can it be blamed on the absence of a vaccine instead of the more likely culprit, an unhealthy lifestyle? When assessing the impact of vaccines, removing the body's many other biomolecular principles and functions from the equation is completely unreliable, totally, 100% unscientific. The claim that a vaccine can prevent disease without looking at many other critical health factors in a person's life is contrary to a scientific gold standard for assessing health and illness. It is no different than if a person took vitamin C every day for a year and did not come down with a cold, and then said it was exclusively because of vitamin C intake that deserves all the credit for being healthy for that year. Not true. It may or may not have contributed. But based upon that criteria alone, you could not with any scientific certainty or justification say the vitamin C prevented the cold. Maybe you were happier that year. Maybe you gave yourself more rest. Maybe you had better sleep. Maybe you had more engaging relationships. Maybe that you were more creative. All of those are capable of stimulating a positive immune response. So just as it is impossible to equate one nutrient intake with the health of a person and therefore make claim that it was that nutrient that benefited the person, so too they cannot, with any single or combination vaccine, say that this is what prevented your condition and therefore we're taking 100% of the credit. So if you are vaccinated and you did not come down with the flu, they cannot, should not, and not be allowed to claim that this number of people or this percentage didn't get the flu because they got the vaccine. That is voodoo science. There is a strong evidence suggesting that all clinical trials carried out by vaccine manufacturers fall short of demonstrating vaccine efficacy accurately. And when they're shown to be efficacious, it is frequently in the short term and offer only partial protection. According to an article in the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Infectious Disease, which is the gold standard of journals, the only way to evaluate vaccines is to scrutinize the epidemiological data obtained from real-life conditions. In other words, researchers simply cannot or will not adequately test a vaccine's effectiveness and immunogenicity prior to its release on an unsuspecting public. Based upon our research, a study has yet to be undertaken anywhere in the world in the history of vaccinology that evaluates the long-term progress of a fully vaccinated versus an unvaccinated group of children of comparable biochemistries, genetics, ages, lifestyles, diet, and environments, and follows both for at least 5 years, and then on a quarterly basis doing full blood workups and immunological assessments to determine how did the vaccinated group do, how did the non-vaccinated group do. That has never been done. And because it's never been done, They have no right and should not be allowed to tell you that the vaccines used by individuals are the reason for an absence of illness. Since immunity hinges on more than vaccination status, it stands to reason that the only way to make a fair determination about the effectiveness of the current vaccine schedule will be to carry out such an analysis using a gold standard of the scientific methodology and protocol. Why has this never been done? This is not a difficult task. To understand this unanswered question, we must look back at vaccinology's history and the scientific evidence that would implicate our national vaccine campaign as a dangerous and deceptive experiment upon the public. Let us take on one of the biggest influences upon doctors and patients to use a vaccine. Well, it prevented polio. It ended the polio epidemic. No, it did not. Almost everyone now believes that vaccines were responsible for the eradication of major epidemics in the United States and around the world. However, this belief is largely propaganda overcoming true science and facts. The story of Jonas Salk's polio vaccine is an example of some vaccines that not only fail to save lives, but actually infect the patients with the very disease they're supposed to protect against. The polio vaccine is recognized as the fastest approved drug in FDA history. In 1955, it only took 2 hours of review before its approval, licensure, and to be quickly released to the public. Owing to the fact that no significant scientific research could ever have been carried out on the vaccine in such a short span of time, the vaccine was quickly administered without proper federal review. Known as the Cutter incident, after the vaccine's manufacturer, Cutter Laboratories, within days of vaccination, 40,000 children became infected with polio, 200 severely paralyzed, and 10 died, all because of the polio vaccine. Shortly thereafter, the vaccine was quickly withdrawn from circulation and abandoned. Question: have you ever had any physician, nurse, pharmacist, legislator, head of a government body overseeing vaccines such as the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, come forward and tell you the story of how we, the American public, were infected with polio, 440,000 cases, with multiple deaths because of their experiment, gone amok? The answer is no. The CDC's website still promulgates a blatant untruth that the Salk vaccine was a miracle in public health policy. To the contrary, officials at the National Institutes of Health were convinced the vaccine was contributing to a rise in polio and paralysis in the 1950s. In 1957, Edward McBean documented in his book, The Poison Needle, that government officials stated the vaccine was, quote, worthless as a prevention and dangerous to take, end quote. Some U.S. states, such as Idaho, where several people died after receiving the Salk vaccine, wanted to hold the vaccine makers legally liable. Dr. Salk himself testified in 1976 that his live virus vaccine, which contributed to the continued to be distributed in the U.S. until 2000, was, quote, the principal, if not sole cause, of all polio cases in the United States since 1961. Let me repeat that so you're clear. That it was Dr. Jonas Salk, who I personally spoke with. Here is what he said under oath, quote, that the vaccine, his vaccine, the live virus vaccine, was the principal, if not sole cause, of all polio cases in the United States since 1961. However, after much lobbying and political leveraging, the pharmaceutical industry pressured the U.S. Public Health Service to proclaim the vaccine safe. Against this occurred a different background. in the 1950s, this same private industry game plan to coerce and through the use of lobbyists, consultants, current and former government employees to influence government health agencies to do their bidding. Today, the U.S. health authorities proudly claim the U.S. is polio-free. Medical authorities and the advocates of mass vaccination rely upon the polio vaccine as an example of a vaccine that eradicated a virus and as proof of the unfounded herd immunity theory, which is nothing more than a flawed theory. They are wrong. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, a board-certified nephrologist who has spent more than 10,000 hours of scholarship studying everything, researching every single study in the vaccine literature on the safety and efficacy of vaccines, has documented that polio's disappearance was actually a game of smoke and mirrors. In her research, she has shown how the alleged eradication of polio coincided with the rise of a new and strikingly similar set of ailments, which have been described as variations of a condition known as acute flaccid paralysis. Now, thanks to Dr. Humphreys and Janine Roberts, a great distinguished investigative journalist, they detailed the data. It's not difficult to connect the dots and see that the reported decline in cases of polio over the years has more to do with calling the disease by different names and hence sticking them under a different category, hiding them in a different closet, than actually eradicating it. Another layer of treachery in the history of the polio vaccine is the story of Dr. Maurice Hillman, a pioneer in the field of vaccine research at Merck in the 1950s, who developed over 40 vaccines, including 5 of the 14 immunizations routinely given to children and adults today. He is considered the father of vaccine in America. In a candid interview, Dr. Hillman explained that monkey DNA was used in some of the vaccines he developed, and it was impossible to screen out all the viruses carried by the monkeys. He discovered that the new Sabin polio vaccine contained simian virus 40, or SV40, a DNA virus shown to be carcinogenic. During vaccine trials in hamsters, SV40 was shown to cause tumors. Hillman said, quote, "We knew it was in our seed stock from making vaccines. It was good science at the time because that was what you did. You didn't worry about these wild viruses," end quote. The precise number of Americans exposed to vaccines contaminated with the carcinogen SV40 remains unknown, but estimates are as high as 100 million Americans. As of 2001, Neil Miller, a vaccine research journalist, counted 62 separate peer-reviewed studies confirming the presence of SV40 in a variety of human tissues and different carcinomas. Let's now examine the decline of epidemic disease and getting to the truth. What has contributed historically to the decline of scourges like smallpox, polio, tetanus, measles, and diphtheria? Although many attribute the decreased incidence of these diseases to the introduction of vaccines, a look at the actual epidemiological data indicates that many, if not most, infectious diseases started declining noticeably prior to the introduction of their vaccines due to significant improvements in the way we live, sanitation, proper sewage disposal, clean water, improved nutrition, indoor plumbing, less crowded conditions, elimination of child labor, better hygiene, pasteurization of milk, the chlorination of water. These were done from the late 1800s right through till the 1900s. Now, in 1920s, there were 7,229 cases. In 1921, and that is just one example, polio. And then go forward. By 1951, there are 3,281 cases. But here's what people fail to understand because they have not done the homework. By the time the polio vaccine became widespread in 1961, the number of cases were down to 1,076. There is no scientific sound evidence that mass inoculation can be credited with eliminating any infectious disease. Furthermore, if vaccination is responsible for the disappearance of these diseases in the United States, why did they simultaneously disappear in Europe prior to mass vaccination? Now, I have graphs that I have posted today for you to examine that show a large drop in disease death rates occurred long before vaccinations for those specific diseases were introduced. Examples. From 1900 to 1963, when the measles vaccine was introduced, death rates from measles had declined from 13.3 per 100,000 to 0.2 per 100,000. That is a 98% decrease of measles deaths before the vaccine was even introduced. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from whooping cough declined from 12.2 per 100,000 to 0.5 per 100,000. That's a 96% decrease. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from diphtheria declined from 40.3 per 100,000 to 0.4 per 100,000. That's a 99% decrease in deaths from diphtheria. Now, these graphs demonstrate clear and major changes in the severity of disease well before any vaccines were introduced. This alone should take away all of the power to suggest that it was the vaccines that were responsible when they weren't even invented until the diseases were almost entirely eradicated. What could have caused that difference? As I said, it was the quality of good hygiene and the central factors of disease prevention that I mentioned. The press never recommends measures people can adopt to best protect themselves against viral bacterial disease aside from vaccination. So the data suggests that public health interventions are the single cause. And also these interventions, natural interventions, are very easy to take care of many viruses and bacteria. The manufacturing mythology in vaccines development involves taking a disease agent and rendering it gradually weaker so that the body's own immune system is triggered and antibodies are generated. Those are referred to as humoral immunity. However, the body's immune system is far greater than targeted by vaccines. In addition to humoral immunity, there is also cell-mediated immunity. And cell-mediated immunity activates macrophages and natural killer cells, antigen-specific cytotoxic T lymphocytes, and the release of various cytokines in response to a viral antigen. Current vaccine science lacks a way to stimulate the entire immune response instead of just a portion of it. Normal exposure to disease-causing agents always begins in the nasal, ear, throat, and respiratory passages, less so through injection. Once primary immunity has been established by infection, the antibody response follows. This allows the immune system to grow stronger and bestow natural and permanent lifetime immunity to an ever-increasing number of pathogens. Vaccines injected into the body bypass cell-mediated immunity and overstimulate humoral immunity. This confuses normal immune response maturation and skews the function of the immune system. Humoral immunity becomes dominant, and the crucial cell-mediated immunity is suppressed. The result can be autoimmune disease and frequent infections. All you have to do is speak with most mothers and fathers about the state of their child's health before immunization and after, and you'll see that we now suffer from an epidemic of asthma-like conditions and autoimmune conditions, inner ear infections, as examples, wheezing. According to R.M. Zinkernagel at the University Hospital of Zurich, Institute of Experimental Biology, quote, "We have not succeeded in generating truly protective vaccines against persistent infections because we cannot imitate the infection immunity that is long-lasting, generating protective TMB cell-stimulated cells against variable infections without causing disease by either immunopathology or tolerance, end quote. In just lay language, what that means is that when you're breastfeeding, you're getting full immunity. When you're out playing as a kid and you play in the dirt, as all of us did at one time, you're getting exposed to different microorganisms. That actually creates immunity. When you get chickenpox and the measles and the mumps, you're now immune for life. Not so if you're given an artificial versus natural immune injection. The weak correlation between antibody count and immunity is not a new discovery. Wayleen James, author of Immunization, The Reality Behind the Myth, explains that increased antibody production may not be the most important aspect of the immune process. I'll quote her verbatim. Vaccines isolate antibody function and allow to substitute for the entire immune response. Scientific evidence questioning the role of antibodies in disease protection can be found in research performed by Dr. Alec Burton, published in a study by the British Medical Council in May 1950. The study investigates the relationship between the incidence of diphtheria and the presence of antibodies. Since diphtheria was epidemic, or just prior to it, its epidemic, the time of the study, the researchers had a large number of cases to investigate. The purpose of the research was to determine the existence or non-existence of antibodies in people who developed diphtheria and those who did not. It looked at patients and people who were in close proximity to patients, such as physicians, nurses in hospitals, family and friends. The conclusion was that there was no relation whatsoever between antibody count and incidence of disease. The researchers found people who were highly resistant with extremely low antibody counts and people who developed the disease who had very high antibody counts. Dr. Burton also discovered that children born with an A-gamma globule, the inability to produce antibodies, developed and recovered from measles and other infections or contagious diseases almost as spontaneously as other children, end quote. Meaning, this whole idea that the vaccine gives you protective large amounts of antibodies, and you have to have those to be protected, this has been shown not to be true. Because here, they had kids that had no ability to produce these antibodies who were still protected or recovered. And those who had high antibodies came down with the illness. One of the foremost issues surrounding vaccine-induced immunity is that infants are biologically incapable of producing antibodies, other than immature IgM antibodies, until 6 to 12 months of age. Now, it's very important that you understand what I'm sharing with you now. When you're in a hospital and your child is born, within hours it's given a hepatitis B vaccine. Within days it's given other vaccines. Within the first year, it's given all of these vaccines. And yet, listen carefully, that vaccine-induced immunity is what they're trying to create and tell you is happening. However, infants are biologically incapable of producing all these antibodies other than immature IgM antibodies until 6 to 12 months of age. The antibodies the infant acquires, such as immunoglobulins, are passed down from mother to child through breast milk. Nevertheless, the current CDC schedule calls for more than a dozen injections during the first 6 months of life. If the immunological function of a fully grown adult is disrupted so significantly by vaccines, what sort of harm can we expect these same vaccines to inflict upon the delicate physiology of an infant? And even if you believed in vaccines, what would be the benefit versus the harm of waiting for the first 2 years of life so that the infant now, as a toddler, has some natural immunity going on and therefore is less likely to suffer from sudden infant death syndrome, which in other countries that have put their vaccine schedule further back is almost non-existent compared to the United States. Now I want to examine some of the most compelling examples of vaccines failing among the most widely used vaccines in America today. First, influenza. At the top of our understanding should be that virtually all the media use the talking points from the FDA and the CDC to make the following statement. Well, it's that time of year, you should be getting your flu shots because 36,000 people die each year from the flu. That is an out-and-out lie. If you go to the CDC website, and you, as we have, and collected all their data before they change it or erase it, you will see over the last 15 years that they've combined influenza with pneumonia, two different conditions, and therefore come up with 36,000. We have found years where there were people only in the hundreds who died of influenza, and even in those that were checked, they didn't all have influenza. They didn't have the flu. They had other conditions mimicking influenza. In fact, the average year was closer to about 1,400. We're dealing in a country with 325 million citizens, and you got 1,500 that die from the flu, and you say it's an epidemic and everyone should be vaccinated. No, it's not an epidemic. They have manipulated the figures. They're wrong. And the media, not doing its job ever when it comes to public health, is merely acting as their puppeteers there. Now, someone you can trust, impeccably done science, is the Cochrane Collaboration, the foremost group of unbiased researchers in the world. They have done a series of meta-analysis on the effectiveness of the influenza vaccine with similar results. In 2014, they found that vaccinating adults against influenza did not affect the number of people hospitalized nor decrease lost work. Cochrane researchers stated that their results might be overly optimistic due to the fact that 24 of the 90 studies were funded by the vaccine manufacturers, which tend to produce results favorable to their vaccines. According to Dr. Tom Jefferson of the Cochrane Collaboration, it makes little sense to keep vaccinating against seasonal influenza based upon the evidence. Jefferson has also endorsed more cost-effective and scientifically proven methods of minimizing transmission of flu. Regular washing of your hands or wearing masks, like on an airplane or where you're around a lot of people who may have the infection. Dr. Jefferson's conclusions are backed by a 2013 piece written by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine scientist Dr. Peter Doshi, published in the British Journal of Medicine. In his article, Dr. Doshi questions the flu vaccine paradigm, stating, quote, "Closer examination of influenza vaccine policy shows that although proponents employ the rhetoric of science, the studies underlying the policy are often of low quality and do not substantiate officials' claims. The vaccine might be less beneficial and less safe than has been claimed, and the threat of influenza appears overstated," end quote. The CDC currently recommends that elderly Americans receive a flu shot, stating, quote, "Vaccination is especially important for people 65 and older because they are at higher risk of complications from flu," end quote. Unfortunately, this serious warning flies in the face of scientific fact. The entire body of research shows that receiving the flu shot does not reduce mortality among seniors. One particularly compelling 2005 study was carried out by the scientists at the Federal National Institutes of Health and published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Not only did the study indicate that the flu vaccine did nothing to prevent deaths from influenza among seniors, but that the flu death rates, in fact, increased as a greater percentage of seniors receiving the vaccine. The takeaway message for seniors: you're much better off washing your hands, taking vitamin D, vitamin C, and also not using the shot because you're more likely to die. After the release of the study, investigative journalist Cheryl Atkinson covered the findings in a CBS News segment. Atkinson revealed that she hoped to interview the study's lead author at the National Institutes of Health, but was stonewalled by the agency. She eventually spoke to the only co-author of the study who was not affiliated with the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Tom Reichert, who stated that the research team revisited the data several times, but that no matter how they analyzed it, quote, the incendiary material, the conclusion was clear. Flu shots don't improve death rates in the elderly population. Another important consideration in this discussion is that there are approximately 200 distinct viruses that constitute influenza and influenza-like illnesses. These organisms don't magically appear during fall and winter. They are always with us. Nevertheless, we are more susceptible to flu-like infections during the colder months when there are less hours of daylight. Studies suggest that the origin of the so-called flu season may actually be the reduced amount of sunlight in the wintertime, with the result that we become deprived of vitamin D. Now let's examine Gardasil. The history of the Gardasil vaccine illustrates clearly the concerning lack of oversight on the part of our federal health authorities when it comes to testing vaccines for efficacy. Before receiving FDA approval, the popular human papillomavirus vaccine Gardasil was tested on fewer than 1,200 girls. A major flaw in Merck's clinical trials was the number of girls enrolled in the trial who elected to take the prescribed three vaccine doses. Only 27% of all the girls tested were actually administered the complete three vaccine series. Another remarkable misstep in the trials was that no girls under 15 participated, despite the fact that the vast majority of girls given the vaccine today are under 15 years old. Nevertheless, the vaccine was approved by the FDA in 2006. In 2014, approximately 60% of all American girls and 40% of all boys ages 13 to 17 received at least one of the human papilloma shots. The remarkable unscientific methodology employed during the Gardasil pre- and post-licensure trials was reviewed in a 2012 analysis by scientists at the University of British Columbia and published in the Journal of Current Pharmaceutical Design. The research team didn't mince words in their assessment of the trials. Quote, "We carried out a systematic review of the human papillomavirus vaccine pre- and post-licensure trials to assess the evidence of their effectiveness and safety. We found that human papillomavirus vaccine clinical trials design and data interpretation of both efficacy and safety outcomes are largely inadequate. Additionally, we note evidence of selective reporting of results from clinical trials and that the exclusion of vaccine efficacy figures related to study subgroups in which efficacy might be lower or even negative from peer-reviewed publications. Given this, the widespread optimism regarding human papilloma vaccines' long-term benefits appears to rest on a number of unproven assumptions, as such, which at odds with factual evidence, and significant misinterpretations of available data," end quote. More doubts about the FDA approval of Gardasil have come from an unlikely source, Dr. Diane Harper, a consultant for Merck and the chief scientist overseeing the licensure trials to evaluate Gardasil's safety and efficacy. After receiving FDA approval, Dr. Harper publicly questioned Gardasil's efficacy and public health value. Among her concerns is that no data shows that Gardasil remains effective after 5 years. A truly effective human papilloma vaccine, on the other hand, would need to be efficacious for 15 years in order to prevent cervical cancer. In addition, she estimated that every American 11 years of age, a girl, would have to be vaccinated for the next 60 years in order to have any measurable effect on rates of cervical cancer. Gardasil's efficacy in protecting against human papilloma vaccine infection has also been criticized due to the fact that it originally only targeted 4 of the more than 100 strains in circulation. In 2014, the FDA approved Gardasil 9, which supposedly protects against 9 strains. Scientists from the University of Texas presented research at the 2015 meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research revealing that vaccinated women were significantly at higher risk to become infected with the strange human papillomavirus not contained in the vaccine when compared to unvaccinated women, or those that were contained in the vaccine, meaning those who were vaccinated were at greater risk of coming down with infection. This disturbing revelation is just the most recent piece of evidence demonstrating Gardasil's dubious effectiveness and potentially hazardous impact on human biochemistry. Another study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2007 demonstrates the ineffective nature of Gardasil in women with human papillomavirus. The authors concluded that Gardasil offers no benefit to women recovering from human papillomavirus during a 12-month period. The research team stated, quote, "They see no reason to believe that there is therapeutic benefit of the vaccine elsewhere because the biological effects of vaccinating against already infected women is not expected to vary by population," end quote. Given the high rate of recovery for people with human papillomavirus infections, the widespread use of the vaccine is highly suspect. Even the National Cancer Institute has stated the, quote, "Most high-risk human papillomavirus infections occur without any symptoms, go away within 1 to 2 years, and do not cause cancer," end quote. In fact, 90% of all cases of human papillomavirus infection disappear within 2 years. Cervical cancer is highly curable when early detected. It's important to note that advances in medicine, the regular use of pap smears, have helped decrease the incidence of cervical cancer in the United States by over 50% since the 1970s. Examining health data from Finland and the United Kingdom, Dr. Harper and her colleagues concluded that human papillomavirus vaccinations give a false sense of security to many young women and girls who in turn opt out of regular pap smear tests. According to Dr. Harper, this trend has resulted in exponential increases in recent human papillomavirus rates. Even more alarming, Gardasil has gained notoriety as one of the most dangerous vaccines for its serious life-threatening adverse effects. As of October 2015, the federal program known as the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System has received over 41,000 cases of adverse reactions from the human papillomavirus vaccine, including 234 deaths. Now let's examine whooping cough, or pertussis. The vaccine for pertussis, better known as whooping cough, is packaged together with diphtheria and tetanus. It is known as the DTaP, and given according to a robust vaccine schedule of 5 injections by age 6. It is the most administered vaccine in the childhood vaccine schedule at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 15 to 18 months, and 4 to 6 years. Despite regular administration of booster shots, scientific evidence now suggests that the vaccine does not effectively confer immunity against pertussis. At one recent study published in Clinical Infectious Diseases puts it, quote, "Pertussis is currently the least well-controlled vaccine-preventable disease despite excellent vaccination coverage and 6 vaccine doses recommended between 2 months of age and adolescence," end quote. The ineffective nature of the pertussis vaccine was brought into sharp focus in 2010 when California witnessed a dramatic rise in whooping cough cases. Over 9,100 people became infected, many of them children. A study assessing the vaccine's efficacy discovered that an extraordinarily high 80% of all children who contracted the illness were fully vaccinated. Hence, where is the efficacy? If you say this prevents an illness and you have a large number of people come down with the very illness who are vaccinated, then clearly it is not effective. One explanation for the pertussis vaccine's remarkable lack of efficacy has been found in a 2010 study undertaken at Penn State Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics. The team found that the whooping cough vaccine promotes the colonization of Bordetella pertussis, and this is a causal bacterial agent. Based upon their findings, the researchers posited that the whooping cough vaccine itself may be contributing to the marked resurgence of whooping cough cases compared to previous decades. Further evidence casting doubt on the whooping cough vaccine's usefulness was presented at a 2013 meeting of the CDC's Board of Scientific Counselors, Office of Infectious Disease. During the meeting, CDC officials pointed out that the widespread use of the DTP vaccine has given rise to more virulent pertussis strains. What is novel about these new emerging strains is they lack a particular what is called PRN, pertactin, the antigen current pertussis vaccines target. The meeting's participant noted that, quote, vaccinated patients had significantly higher odds than unvaccinated patients of being infected with PRN deficient strains, end quote. Another recent study surveyed the incidence of whooping cough in 8 states. The survey found that fully vaccinated children were 200% to 400% more likely to contract the PRN deficient strain than the unvaccinated population. A further reason for the pertussis vaccine's failure to control communal infection is because vaccinated children may become asymptomatic carriers of the pathogen. There is strong evidence that vaccinated populations may be infected with a whooping cough but not present any symptoms. The serious downside to this is that asymptomatic carriers can transmit the disease to unvaccinated individuals, especially infants who run the highest risk of suffering complications from pertussis. It also tends to lead credence to new research implicating vaccinated older siblings, not parents, as the primary source of infection for whooping cough among infants. This research runs counter to the entire notion of herd immunity. It calls it out for what it is, unscientific. Now, what does it mean? Think if you're a school teacher listening to this broadcast. Think of how many of your students come in who've been vaccinated, let's say, for the flu vaccine, with a live vaccine, shot in the nose, you know, sprayed in the nose, or a kid vaccinated for whooping cough. They're shedding live viruses. It's on their hands, it's in the air, it's on the surface of desks, and that means that another kid can pick it up. At home, the kids who have been vaccinated can then infect those that have yet to be and other people. So they have not taken this into account, but now they're seeing the effect. Now let's go to the measles. The efficacy of the measles vaccine has also come under serious scrutiny in recent years. In 2014, Dr. Gregory Polin, editor-in-chief of the journal Vaccine and founder of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group, published an alarming statement that the measles vaccine has a poor efficacy record. Despite the 95% measles vaccination compliance among children entering kindergarten and the CDC's propaganda that the MMR vaccine has defeated the virus, measles outbreak continued to increase. During the first half of 2014, there were 16 large measles outbreaks in the U.S. Dr. Poland does not believe this is due to unvaccinated individuals, but because of the vaccine's failure to confer immunity. During the first 6 months of 2011, there were 118 cases of measles reported to the CDC from 23 states and New York City. There were no deaths. Among the 118 cases, 105 were both import-associated and unvaccinated. Of the 87 U.S. residents who came down with measles, 74 were unvaccinated, 39 were under the age of 20, and the CDC focused heavily on the unvaccinated measles victims while giving virtually no attention to the analysis of those who were fully vaccinated who came down with measles. In fact, 13 of the group, that's 17.5%, had received the MMR vaccine but got measles anyway. While the CDC uses these incidents of disease outbreaks to stress the need for vigilant adherence to the vaccine schedule, the real take-home message here is, hey, 17.5% of a group of vaccinated individuals got sick despite the vaccine. One thing, however, is certain. All of the unvaccinated people who came down with the measles now have lifelong immunity against measles. For those who become infected despite having been vaccinated, we just don't know. Could the vaccine prevent these people from developing the normal lifetime immunity? No scientific research has been undertaken to prove that point. Likewise, 1985 measles outbreak in a Texas community found that 14 students out of 1,806 who contracted measles were all fully vaccinated, no exceptions. and no reports of exposure from foreign endemic areas or any other students. Then look at the chickenpox, that's varicella. The chickenpox vaccine is yet another example of failed science. The present vaccine was licensed in 1995. Following its release, an estimated 25% of children were still spreading the varicella virus or getting the ill themselves. Anne Gershon, a chickenpox expert and director of pediatric infectious disease at Columbia University Medical Center, says, quote, "We really need boosters of vaccines much more than we thought we would ever have to need," end quote. This begs the question, how many boosters would be enough? Our vaccines do not confer lifetime immunity. Therefore, to compensate for vaccines' limitations and steady decline in improving immunity, more and more boosters are required. Consequently, in 2006, the CDC recommended that a second chickenpox shot be added to the childhood vaccination schedule. Gershon says, quote, "Looks like a second shot will keep children from getting sick. Where's the proof?" There is none. Research into the efficacy of the varicella inoculation, however, has increased skepticism about the vaccine. In 2005, South Korea mandated the chickenpox vaccine to every child under 15 months. Regardless of the country's almost 97% compliance, well above herd immunity claims to eradicate infectious disease, chickenpox infections have not declined. Rather, between 2006 and 2007, there have been a 300% increase in chickenpox cases. American research has also yielded proof of a significant higher rate of vaccine failure despite its widespread administration. Then look at mumps. Mumps infection is another virus frequently found in vaccinated populations. 2006, the U.S. experienced the largest nationwide mumps epidemic in 20 years, primarily infecting students on college campuses. Authorities have attempted to blame these outbreaks on crowded dormitory conditions instead of considering the obvious. The vaccine simply isn't effective very long. 2009 and 10, New York and New Jersey witnessed over 1,500 mumps cases among highly vaccinated groups. 80% of infected children had received at least one vaccine, and 75% had received two vaccines. According to Dr. Jane Zucker, New York City Assistant Commissioner of Immunization, quote, "We know that approximately one in every 20 people who are vaccinated may not develop antibodies," end quote. A Reuters reporter went even further, stating, quote, "The mumps virus can mutate, so people who have only one or even two doses of vaccine remain vulnerable," end quote. How can a vaccine with such negligible immunity not only be recommended but required for school attendance? There's no science behind it. It is certainly reasonable and responsible to suggest that if a vaccine were proven to be safe and effective by a gold standard of science, it would be an important health service for every child and adult, and I would recommend them. However, at this moment, no such assurance can be made based upon quality science. At the very least, we should require unbiased, independent, double-blind, placebo-controlled studies of every vaccine, both individually and collectively, with no input whatsoever from anyone associated with the vaccine manufacturers or the pharmaceutical industry, or their colleagues, associates, or consultants. To ensure a healthier future, it is crucial that we stand up today and demand a new paradigm of vaccinology based upon independent, science-based medicine. I'm Gary Nall. This ends part two of my special ongoing investigative report on vaccines. I've now presented two reports, one on safety and one on efficacy. My next report will go into the politics of vaccinology, how they were allowed because of a lobbyist working on their behalf, a politician who would later become a very powerful and wealthy consultant for pharmaceutical industry, including the vaccine lobby, how this protection clause was put into a bill that became law. Hence today, if every single person in America that received a vaccine died, there would not be a single lawsuit allowed to be filed. They're protected. Also, the government's the largest purchaser of vaccines, upwards of 70%. Well, if you have people working inside governmental agencies as policymakers, which they do, if you have a preponderance of the people on different advisory committees within the FDA and the CDC and the National Institutes of Health on what recommendations should be for a vaccine and scheduling, and they do, And if you cannot be sued and the government is paying you to develop vaccines, and then you get to keep the patent on them, which they have, then just imagine how it easily will go above $100 billion a year industry in the near future. It's tens of billions now, and you have no downside at all. And we're supposed to believe that this is good public health. No, teaching people about their immune system in its entirety, showing them how to prevent disease by proper nutrition, stress management, exercise, cleaning up your work and home environment, and reducing the conditions that cause the immune system to be compromised, that is where we have our emphasis, and we have done nothing there at all. Zero. If you doubt me, I would like for you to ask this question. When was the last time you saw the Surgeon General, the President of the United States, the head of National Institutes of Health, and the different agencies on television giving you recommendations for the fruits and vegetables, the juices, the plant-based diet, the fibers, the vitamin D and C and E and zinc, all of which are supported by strong scientific evidence? They help stimulate a stronger immunity and prevent disease. You have not, it has never happened, and it won't, because the pharmaceutical industry has the influence they do. All of my statements today are fully corroborated. My footnotes, end notes, there are dozens. There are, for this particular study, there are 53 scientific footnotes. And the two articles, part one and part two, are now posted. I suggest that you not only read them, but you share them. Share them with every site that you can think of, because this is information that I'm not aware is being distributed by any other major media. And we are the leading voice for progressive ideals and information in the world. And I want to thank the hundreds of millions of people who came in the last 12 months and took down information and shared it. Continue reading and sharing. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy.
Oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone.